This meeting of the Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability is called to order. We obviously have a lot of people who are very interested in this issue today. We want to make sure that everyone who wants to has an opportunity to speak. Right now, we don't have that many witness slips, although I do know from talking to some of my colleagues, we have lots of questions from up here. If anyone would like to speak, feel free to fill out a witness slip at some point. I'm going to read some of the people who have already filled one out. Janice Bonneville already is front and center, ready for a lot of questions. Matt Brown is here, Chief Procurement Officer of the state. Linda Brookhart, Executive Director of State University Annuitants Association, will be speaking later as well, as will Otto Fofoglia. We have a written comment here. Thank you very much. And Beverly Jones, retiree, oral testimony as well. Just a reminder, if you haven't filled out a witness slip and you do want to speak, please do that and get it from someone on staff. But I want to thank the commission for meeting here and co-chair Representative Tracy. And I think we'll probably begin. I'm so excited to begin. I forgot for the clerk to please call the roll.
Representative Burke. Senator Frerichs.
Here.
Senator Kaler. Here. Senator Murphy. Representative Nekritz. Representative Poe.
Here.
Representative Riley.
Here.
Senator Rose.
Yes.
Senator Severson.
Yes.
Representative Tracy.
Here.
Senator Trotter. Representative Tryon.
Okay.
There's nine in attendance. Nine.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. So I know that I have a lot of questions myself. I think I'd like to begin with some questions for the entire commission, and then we'll let other commissioners ask questions as well. And I know a lot of these will probably be answered by you, Janice, and also Matt Brown. Would you guys mind both coming up together? Thank you very much. So I'd just like to start off for the edification of the commission and people here in attendance. Could you guys start with an explanation of the contract and the bid process for the recent Medicare Advantage supplemental procurement? I think you might have to turn your mic on. It is at the base of your mic on the back side. There's a little button. Go up a little higher. There you go.
How's that? There we go. Great. Good morning, co-chairs, members of the committee. I'll field the answers, field that question rather. This particular procurement was a procurement specifically authorized by the General Assembly to put forward a methodology to procure Medicare-related health insurance for state retirees and employees who would qualify for co-benefit based on their age. This is a procurement that was mandated by law to be concluded in a very short period of time. The procurement in itself, authorized by this law, was exempt from the procurement code, but for four particular articles that deal with disclosures, ethics reviews, and the participation of both CMS and the state's chief procurement officer.
Okay, and it resulted in four companies being selected, is that correct?
That's correct.
Can you give us an overview as to why those four companies were selected?
The RFP was written, Janice Bonneville, Deputy Director of Benefits for CMS. The RFP was written with the clear intent to award a single contract for a nationwide PPO product, one or more HMO products, and then the potential for the award of a Med Sup product. So the end result of the RFP was indeed a single contract award to UnitedHealthcare for a nationwide PPO. There were three HMO contracts awarded. The structure of the RFP was such that the HMO award would initially be given to the top scoring bidder, technical and price. A second award would be issued if the second bidder could provide HMO coverage to 10% or more members that the original bidder couldn't cover. And if they could do that, then they would be given their entire service area as it was bid. So the first award was given to Aetna under the Coventry Advantra Medicare Advantage program. The second award was given to Humana because they were able to cover an additional 10% of the retiree lives under an HMO product. And the third award was also given to Humana because under that award they were able to provide HMO coverage in two counties where HMO coverage would otherwise not have existed.
Okay. I have some questions about minimum mandatory requirements regarding lives in an employer group and a public group. It's been a little bit an issue I've heard from a lot of my constituents. Can you please explain why there were these minimum requirements in the RFP?
In each of the RFPs that we've done for purposes of healthcare, we have minimum mandatory requirements so that we are reaching those providers that are able to give the kind of coverage and the kind of access that an employer group our size needs to have. We're talking about a retiree group in excess of 100,000. Roughly, when you talk retirees and dependents, roughly 25% of our entire book of business. So we have about 475,000 lives. This procurement touches approximately 128,000 of those. The original procurement, as written, had the same minimum mandatory requirements for both the PPO and the HMOs. Upon further review and before release of the RFP, the minimum mandatory requirements for the HMOs, because they were constrained to the state, were significantly lowered in order to allow HMOs, localized HMOs, to bid on that procurement.
So what was the requirement?
The minimum mandatory requirement for the HMO was at least 5 years of experience administering Medicare Advantage plans, a minimum of 3 years administering Medicare Advantage plans for one or more employers who have individually a minimum of 1,000 participants enrolled in the Medicare Advantage plans the vendors offer. Vendors must have at least 1 year of experience administering Medicare Advantage plans for a public sector employer with a minimum of 500 participants from the public sector employer.
Okay. And can you explain how you got to those requirements?
How you
chose those minimums?
Well, again, let me go back to the original language. The original language was 10,000 participants and a minimum of 10,000 with a public sector employer. That was the PPO standard. The HMO standard, as you can see, was reduced significantly, 1,000 and 500. This was after consultation with Siegel Consulting, who is the consultant that assisted us on this RFP, and consistent with what they've seen, and in fact lower than what they've seen in other states who are bidding these same kinds of products.
Okay. Just out of curiosity, where is that company based out of?
We use the office out of Chicago.
Okay. So did all the plans awarded contracts meet this requirement?
All of the plans awarded contracts met this requirement. So we had five bidders on the HMO product, five different bids, and four of the five bids met the minimum mandatory requirements.
Now, did anyone file any requests for waivers of these requirements?
Yes. There was a request by Health Alliance for a waiver of this requirement.
Okay. Was there a possibility of waiving that requirement?
It's a discretion. And it is very specifically not a requirement of the procurement code to establish minimums, maximums, thresholds, ceilings, but it is a best practice in procurement to rely on some bench to say you're either above a line or you're below a line. In this case, by the time the request had arrived for waiver, we had worked with CMS, Janice's office, about the nature of this threshold, and in fact, early on in the development of the RFP, I questioned whether the threshold was high enough as compared to the number of lives covered. This is related to minimus value. And after discussion, what we had determined is the threshold was designed for finding out the capacity of a provider to deal with a network of clients. And so we left that in there. I did not waive, as the chief procurement officer with this authority, I did not waive this minimum requirement for Health Alliance as they requested.
You said you didn't waive it because it was a de minimis value. How do you define de minimis value?
You know, for me, it was to look at the number of lives covered, as Janice described, and say, you know, what does this represent? And the as a percentage of lives, I questioned how that would be representative of the lives covered. Our conversation was less about, you know, the lives covered, and what I realized was it represents an effective network in place, something that can be looked upon to demonstrate covering lives. And it was a threshold that was not, in my mind, inappropriate to set so that we could evaluate whether that network truly exists or not.
Okay, so I'm trying to understand in my mind, you said it didn't affect enough lives. I mean, obviously my constituents, they care very much if it affects their own personal life, but I understand you've got to take a more global view. How many lives are we talking about here?
Well, again,
what affected?
As Janice indicated, the threshold, again, this is just for servicing, was 1,500. And deferring back to Janice's answer, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of insured enrollees. So that's the ratio.
So are you saying the Health Alliance, if they've been allowed to bid and if they submitted a low bid and would have won, would have only affected about 1,000 lives?
I don't think that's the correct analogy. What we're saying
okay.
is about the threshold of 1,500 is that was a value set to represent the internal capacity of a provider. And that was established to say, you know, the state has a scale of 100,000 insured. And we needed to figure out the benchmark to say, do you have enough capacity to handle 100,000 enrollees? That was the selection that was made. And I think, you know, Janice referenced that Siegel Consulting, who advised CMS, said this also seems very low as compared to other jurisdictions.
Okay. I guess probably my idea of low or small is probably a little skewed, and the rest of the commission may disagree with me on this. I'll leave some time for them to ask some questions as well. But I know we have a lot of questions we wanted to ask of you, so I'll continue going through, but I think we might revisit some of these going forward. Let's go out and talk to the United Healthcare Plan, the PPO. Is that a self-insured plan?
No, it's fully insured.
Okay. So can you explain again why one company, Humana, was selected for Livingston and Knox counties?
Certainly.
So those are not very large counties.
No. The way the language in the RFP was written was the first HMO award is made to the top scoring offeror. That offer receives the award for their entire service area. A second award may be made to the next highest scoring offer for its entire service area if, by making the award, coverage is increased by at least 10% of the eligible retiree population by adding the counties covered by that second awardee. A third award, or multiple awards, not necessarily just three, could have been more than three, may be made on a county-by-county basis for those counties not already covered in a Medicare Advantage prescription drug HMO plan. So the RFP allowed us the discretion to give the top award, a second award if by doing so we increase access for 10% or more of our retired population,
okay.
and then subsequent awards if those awards gave us access to counties which didn't already have HMO coverage from the previously made awards.
Okay. So the Humana contract, I assume Livingston and Knox County does not represent 10% or more. So it would be that third criteria?
Correct. That Humana contract is the third.
Specifically to give them an HMO option, those two counties?
Correct. That was the third award made.
Do all other counties have an HMO option?
No.
Okay, so then why then do specifically was Livingston and Knox chosen to give them an HMO option, but I think a few dozen others were not?
Because Livingston and Knox were included in Humana's bid that they had the capacity to provide HMO coverage in those counties. Had they had the capacity to provide HMO coverage in another county that wasn't already covered, that county would have been included as well. But Livingston and Knox were the only two counties in that third bid which were not already covered by an HMO.
Would there have been a fourth bid out there that could have served the other? How many counties in the state of 102 do not have HMO as an option?
48.
48. And were there no other bidders who could have covered some of those 48?
Not of the four that met the requirements, no.
Okay, so you got those requirements. I think there probably be some more questions about those. Can individuals come back to a state plan if they choose to opt out for this or future years?
They can under the state plan. They cannot under TRIP and SIP.
Okay.
I can explain that if you need
to.
Yeah,
please, sir. Please do.
TRIP and SIP, the Teachers Retirement Insurance Program and the College Insurance Program, mm-hmm. were both assumed under the administration of CMS after they had been established at the respective retirement systems, TRS and SURS. In the original development of those plans, eligibility was such that if the person didn't either take the plan when they were first eligible, take it when they became eligible for Medicare, they could not opt in, opt out, and opt back in at a later date. The only exception was eligibility for Medicare, and if somehow that person's other plan ended. Those are the only two exceptions on eligibility. It is not a CMS rule, but the statute provides that the eligibility should be set as it was set at the time the plan was transferred over to CMS. As I sit before you today, CMS would not be opposed to allowing these folks to opt back in if they terminate their coverage in these plans, but under the current rules as they're set in the current statutory guideline, we simply cannot do it.
So that would require legislative action, and then you would not fight that, if something were passed?
That is correct, sir.
Okay. Can you describe the general plan design for the Medicaid Advantage plans, select retirees, including out-of-pocket costs?
Sure. As a general rule, the plans are the same plan design as the retirees see today. When the RFP was let, the plan design as it exists for the state plan, for HMO coverage, and the quality care health plan, and for the teachers and college plans, again, their plan under Cigna as well as their HMO coverage, those plan designs were specifically placed in the RFP to say these are the plan designs you must meet. The exception to that is for the PPO plan. Right now, under the quality care plan, members pay 10% in-network and 30% out-of-network on the state plan. TRIP and SIP, they pay 20 and 40 respectively. The PPO was bid to say there cannot be a differentiation. So whether you go to an in-network doctor or an out-of-network doctor, the plan pays 90% and the member pays 10%. There are other differences in plan design, but as a general rule, those differences are to the benefit of the member. For example, the current copayment or the current deductible for emergency room services in all of the plans is at least $250. The maximum amount for an emergency room deductible for a Medicare Advantage plan is $65, so that's the cap. The plans are designed to not have a Medicare Part D donut hole as a purchase on the street would be. If a member bought a Part D plan on the street today, they would have prescription coverage up to $2,650. And then from $2,650 to $4,550, the member would be responsible for a larger piece of that prescription cost until the plan kicks in again at a catastrophic level. That differentiation and that spread of money does not exist under this plan. They stay in their copayment, which are identical for prescriptions to what they pay right now, from zero to catastrophic. There is no donut hole for those. For TRIP and SIP, if there was a differentiation in the plan designs as they currently exist, the better design was put into this RFP. So there are some differentiations in the TRIP and SIP plans. They are minor, but where there is a difference, we took the better benefit for the member and put it into this plan design.
Do all retirees in counties in Illinois have access to medical providers, facilities, and services in their counties?
Yes. The rule under the PPO plan is the provider must be a Medicare provider. The member can access that provider whether or not they are in the PPO network. If they are not in the PPO network and the provider is willing to bill UnitedHealthcare, they bill UnitedHealthcare and UnitedHealthcare pays that bill. If they're not willing to pay, the member can pay that cost up front. UnitedHealthcare reimburses the member. The member cannot be balanced billed for those charges. The member is only responsible for their percentage of costs based upon either the in-network rate or the Medicare allowable charge.
Okay, so if their provider isn't interested in billing United, mm-hmm. They're responsible for all the expenses and they'll get reimbursed.
Correct? What'll happen is, that is correct, but the reality of it is members will be told that to reach out to United will reach out to that provider. They've already done that in a number of large areas that we've heard of in the press and reached out to those hospitals to say, are you going to be willing to bill us as an out-of-network provider? And they're already having success in getting positive responses from those providers.
Okay. So they've obviously gotten some positive responses. Do they feel confident they have positive responses everywhere?
I don't know that they can.
Because making good progress sounds great for the state, but if you're an individual and your doctor who you've been seeing for 40 years and knows your particular If they're not able to, that's a big concern for you.
If they're not able to, I think the better statement there is if they're not willing to.
Okay. But then what would happen in that case?
Then United would reimburse the member, but United would also be reaching out to that provider to understand why it is, given the fact that United pays exactly the same as Medicare pays, and that provider, if they're in Medicare right now, is already receiving that reimbursement from Medicare, why they wouldn't simply take that reimbursement from United rather than put the animus on the member to manage that cost.
Sure. I'd agree we'd like to see that. But if they didn't, how quickly do you think they would reimburse the member? I mean, one of the issues I think a lot of us have heard from their constituents is in terms of dental care, they've paid and it may take up to a year or so to get reimbursed. And I think we're probably talking about many more expensive bills here.
United's indicating to me that would be within 10 days.
Within 10 days. Okay. Will any retirees currently receiving service from Illinois providers and doctors have to switch to the doctors and providers no matter what state contracted Medicare Advantage plan they choose?
Only if the provider refuses to see them. There was an article this morning in the Champaign paper in the News Gazette, and I think the comments that were made there were accurate. The provider has the right to refuse to provide care. They don't have to go into the network, but the only way the member can't see the provider is if the provider simply decides at this point, even though they have an established relationship with the member, that they're no longer going to provide care to the member. Otherwise, the member can see any provider.
Okay. What happens in the case where the employee or spouse is eligible for Medicare, but the other is not Medicare eligible?
That family unit stays in the plan they're currently in. We are not splitting families. The rule under group health for right now is that members and dependents must be enrolled in the same plan. In order to be in a Medicare Advantage plan, the member must be enrolled in Medicare Parts A and B. If any member of the family is not enrolled in A and B, the entire family unit stays in the plan they're currently in.
Okay. And speaking of family members, I'd like to move on to some issues on dependent recertification. Why do retirees need to recertify their dependents?
The dependent recertification is for all members, not just retirees. The group that went out for, it's what we call group two. Group one, oddly enough, were the community college folks and the local government health plans. Those certifications were done beginning at the end of August. So we did approximately 10,000 before the mailing went out in the end of September. To about 44,000, so a larger group, a little more noise.
Okay. All right. Well, we had a request from a member of the commission. We'll come back to recertification. Okay. I think we have some follow-up questions on Medicare Advantage.
Okay.
Okay. Senator Severson.
Good morning, Matt, Janice. Thank you for joining us. A couple of things you covered. I just want to clarify again because I think there's a lot of confusion over the concept of what is traditionally known as an advantage plan and the type of advantage plan that's being created through this new program, having an open access advantage plan. So the intent is that if a person chooses the PPO or the Open Advantage United plan, it would be similar to what the Cigna plan was currently on the with the fact that they can use any provider.
It'll be equal to what the retirees were used to prior to July 1 of this year. In July 1 of this year, the plan designs were changed for retirees so that they actually had to pay attention to whether their doctor was in or out of network because the percentages applied were different. But that is correct. When the Medicare Advantage plan is designed, that it's 10% regardless of where their provider sits.
And so in this case, a retiree will be able to go to any provider in network or out of network. And benefit-wise, they're going to be covered the same, or their liability, what their out-of-pocket costs are going to be, will be maxed which is based on the federal Medicare reimbursement laws. And so the concern about balanced billing of being not in the network and having a large balanced billing, that's not going to occur. Even if someone, a doctor, not understanding that, would bill a larger number, it wouldn't make any difference because the maximum reimbursement that he'll be paid and the liability for the employee, that's still capped.
That is correct, sir. And I want to be careful, and I've been careful. As you can well imagine, this is a rather large undertaking. The staff in my office will tell you that Saturdays and Sundays aren't very fun, but they're here and they're printing and they're creating. And we've been very careful to make sure that the way we're addressing the in and out of network difference is that the coverage level is consistent. Because obviously you can have a member that could say, well, wait a minute, this doctor's in network and I had this procedure and it was only $100 because they're in network, but the Medicare allowable charge is $200. I'm using easy numbers because I can do that math in my head. So that member, that first member with $100, their 10% is going to be $10. Well, that member who's out of network, their 10% is going to be $20. But ultimately, for every member under the PPO plan, the maximum out-of-pocket is $1,300, and that's in or out. That is not in network $1,300, out of network $1,300. That is in and out of network $1,300.
Right. So $1,300 is the maximum. Regardless of where you go, if you went to Northwestern, if you went to Madison, if you went to Mayo, $1,300 is going to be your cap. Now, it is possible if you're going to an in-network provider that they may have a reimbursement rate that is lower than what the federal allowable charge is. And so that's what you're talking about, that it's possible if you go in-network, you could pay a little bit less out of pocket than that $1,300. You could still hit that $1,300 if you had large enough claims anyways, but on a smaller claim, it's possible that there would be a little bit of a savings if you went to an in-network. But going out of network is not going to be a penalty. So where the public thinks of advantage plans, they think of stricter networks and large copays and big penalties to go out of network. And that's not the case here, that we're going to have that assurance that they can go to the same doctors they're seeing now and be able to get that same or better coverage based on this, what we currently have in place.
That's correct. I mean, my notes to myself remind me that this is not what we would call a commercial off-the-shelf plan. This is our design. This is the commitment that we made in the spring. My recollection is that I talked about these plans no less than 7 hearings last spring. Those are the statements that I made, that was the plan design we were moving forward with. In addition to the legislation, as this body is well aware, this was part of the master negotiations. And I can assure you that I spent many minutes on the phone yesterday indicating and defending my position that the plan design is consistent with the plan design that currently exists.
And what is the anticipated savings for implementing this plan from the overall standpoint, from the dollars in, dollars out from last year to this year? What are we projecting the savings to make this structural change to be?
The targeted savings in the union contract came in at just over $200 million. Without going too far down that path, I can tell you that the anticipation for the 2 years of this plan exceeds that $200 million target. That's our anticipation.
Okay. The which is interesting, and the retirees still will pay. Again, it's important to understand, even though they're not going to have Medicare anymore, they're still going to be responsible to pay their Part B premium. So that doesn't change. They still pay the premium even though they're not necessarily part of Medicare because they're in the Advantage plan.
Correct. They're not in what they consider the quote-unquote traditional Medicare, but they still make that payment to Medicare because that is still used to handle the costs that are associated with their care under the Medicare Advantage plan. So they're still making their Part B premium, and then they're still paying their, under the state plan, 1% of their annuity, and then any cost for dependents they may have enrolled in the plan.
The letters that we saw on the website that would go out to the different retirees, have those letters gone out to them, which indicate what the premiums are going to be?
They are in process right now, hence my staff over the weekend. The trip and SIP letters have all been mailed, and the state letters will all be in the mail probably by the time I leave here this morning.
Am I reading on the trip ones, am I reading it correctly that these rates look like they are much lower than what they currently are paying? So we're lowering the cost and keeping or improving on the benefits on the trip?
Absolutely. The trip and the SIP rates are significantly lower than what members are used to paying right now.
Yeah, that's outrageous.
We'll try to do better, sir.
I thought trip was, I thought we were facing some significant financial shortfalls with TRIP, and so in this case, this is able to work and keep TRIP operating.
This is where we are with TRIP right now, and we are in TRIP and SIP. Both funds are having funding issues. Some of that is due to the way the premiums were set. Some of it is simply due to how quickly the money has moved from one fund to another. Right now, if TRIP receives all of its fiscal year 14 appropriation without concern for money involved in Medicare Advantage, because we simply can't project that until we know the migration for the membership, assuming they get all of their 2014 money in 2014, the TRIP liability at the end will be $171.9 million. That will be their shortfall. That will be their claims hold balance, 171.9. If they don't get all of their money in fiscal year 14, it'll be 258.6. And I only point that out because there has been in the past couple of years some delay in when they get their money. So they got all their fiscal year 13 money in fiscal year 12 money in fiscal year 13, a portion of their fiscal year 13 and 13 and in 14. So as that money is delayed, then that interest continues to grow. I have met with the Teachers Retirement Insurance Advisory Board twice in the last 90 days. I met with them in August after the RFP was let and the bids were in to talk about the overall procurement. And I met with them in October following the release of the award to present them with these bids, with these premiums. I can tell you that at least in certain groups, the response has been quite favorable with regard to these bids. I think that eventually we'll get there.
I guess this would be, and not to really belay the fact, but if we're going to be running a deficit, then I'm sure people are happy having lower premiums, but how does that close that gap, and does that kind of create a problem for larger premium increases in the future, and would it have made more sense to have less of a reduction in premiums now to make sure that system is funded or has a zero balance as opposed to ending up in a hole?
Similar to my comments earlier regarding the ability to opt in or opt out, the mechanism for funding and the mechanism for the setting for premiums for teachers and for college exist in the statute. So I am limited as to the percentage I can charge based upon the percentage of overall costs. I'm also limited in how much money I can raise a premium from year to year. Year to year, the premium cannot be 105%. It can be the max is 105% higher than the year prior. And the premiums are set 75-25 for the member, and the member pays in the opposite direction for the dependent. Fund pays 75, member pays 25 for the member. Fund pays 25, member pays 75 for the dependent.
So this rate is going down only because of the bids coming in for that are less.
That is correct.
I'm going to ask for a clarification here. You said it can't be 105% more than,
the
or it
premiums,
can't be 5% more
it
than?
It can't be 5%. So the
it's
premium
only
total
105% of.
I'm sorry. I apologize. Sure. Yes. For TRIP, that is the case. For SIP, unfortunately, even though it's a smaller plan, the situation is a little bit more egregious. The premiums are set at that similar 75-25, but the underlying funding mechanism for SIP has not been changed in multiple years. It's set at a 0.5%. This is the funding from the other entities outside of the premium. TRIP has a built-in escalator. So we have money flow in from the districts, the current teachers, and from the state, and premiums. Those four things make up funding for TRIP. For SIP, it's the same thing. Current college, community college employees, the community college districts, the state, and the premiums. On the TRIP side, we have the ability to adjust that amount based upon the needs of the fund. On the SIP side, we don't. So the SIP program, which is significantly smaller, the SIP program is approximately 10% of the enrollees that the teachers program has. And the SIP program for fiscal year 14 is estimated to be $40 million in arrears and payments. That's almost 2 years of funding for that program. But there is no ability for us under the statute to change the way that program is funded. There
have been something we may want to look at, even though it's not great news, but we may want to look at, since it's being reduced now, does it make sense to statutorily change that so we can kind of protect that fund in the future by having a slightly higher rate, still lower than what they're currently paying, but have a slightly higher rate to help take care of that funding.
Correct. And I can tell this committee that even though it doesn't exist under the statute, I did meet last week with a group of SIP stakeholders, so representatives from the community colleges, representatives from the State University Annuitants Association, representatives from IEA, representatives from IRTA, regarding the SIP program, and gave them the same overview of where we are with that program and funding and Medicare Advantage as I gave the TRIP group the week prior.
And the reason the payments, we talked to you, talked earlier about the payments, and I think we saw some chuckles because of the not used to having payments in 10 days. The reason that that is because this is a little bit different than our regular group health, that the federal money is going to pass through to the carrier. It's not, the state can't get their hands on that money and hold it. So the federal money goes right to the carrier, who then will pay that claim faster. So we're not going to have a problem like we have with our with the other insurance.
Correct.
That's the reason why that can be paid quicker.
That's correct, sir.
Okay. It is interesting. You know, we keep hearing all this talk about in Washington about we need to have this, you know, some kind of a single payer or federal plan. And here we're getting rid of the federal plan Medicare. We're going to a private insurance company with those evil people, and somehow they're delivering this cost at $300 million less costly than what the federal government was doing through Medicare. So I think that's an interesting point, and obviously a savings. I think that's I think that's only a question I had, so I appreciate taking time to help clarify this, especially the difficulties of explaining how Advantage plans work in an open access market. So thank you to both of you.
Thank you. Senator Rose.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't even know where to begin. We'll start with some miscellaneous. So 3 weeks ago, you announced this with no information to my constituents, left them largely in the dark for the better part of the last 2.5 weeks before sending some information out last Friday that when you read it, I'm a lawyer, I don't understand it. But let's try to clarify a few things for my constituents, of which many are scared beyond belief. And by the way, last time this y'all appeared in front of me, we had a very long discussion about the better communication and outreach that was going to come to the people of Illinois via the RFP process that was going to come over the summer. So I don't really know what to make of that given the events of the last 3 weeks, but I guess I'll take anything said here with a grain of salt. Deductible, the $1,300 deductible that was mentioned for people going to the PPOs. We're already midway through the current fiscal year, people have already started paying on deductibles. Will they get credit for what they've already paid? Because my understanding of this is that under the contracts that are to be awarded, they're not allowed to get credit for what they've already paid.
Okay, first of all, it's a $1,300 out-of-pocket, not a deductible.
Okay.
Under the state plan, there's a $100 deductible. Under TRIP and SIP, there's a $250 deductible. There is no mechanism to
Maximum out-of-pocket is $1,300.
Maximum out-of-pocket under the state plan is $1,300. Under the TRIP and SIP plan, it's $1,000.
Okay.
There is no mechanism under a Medicare Advantage plan for me to waive that deductible to the plan. However, it's our plan. We manage it. I'm currently working through issues with my staff to address where people have paid with the current carriers to do our best to hold the member harmless. With that said, however, you're talking about a plan that's now going to run an additional 6 months longer than what the members are used to. So although members may have already met a deductible now, they will not have another deductible until next January. So it's 6 months one way or the other.
When you say January, you're saying January 14 or January 15?
January 15 would be, if I waive a deductible today, then that means the deductible that they were responsible for last July now becomes an 18-month deductible rather than a 12-month deductible. Because they wouldn't have a new deductible apply until January 15.
So it's your intent to figure out some way to hold people harmless.
It is my intent to figure out some way to hold people harmless on the medical deductible.
You said the letters are going out today.
The letters for TRIP and SIP have already been mailed. Some of the state members have been letters have been mailed. We use internal printing and internal mailing at DHS.
Does that mean the contracts have been signed then?
The contracts have been sent to all the vendors, and it is my to my knowledge, every vendor who has joined us here today has brought back or emailed us electronic copies of those signed documents.
Okay. Something that I clarified on my own, because it's not on the website, and by calling Carl Hospital or Carl folks yesterday about the issue of whether or not people have to pay up front. Thankfully, I was told that Carl doesn't intend to force people to pay up front. So I'm just stating that for the record from my own phone calls on this matter, because there's been no information from the state on that to my constituents, and I would expect them to adhere to that. The last night I happened to go to a very interesting lecture on the rollout of Obamacare, both in Illinois and nationwide. And there was a big discussion at that lecture about how the federal government is trying to downsize Medicare Advantage and, you know, trying to maybe push it off into a corner. You just heard Senator Severson talk about a lot of the positives of a Medicare Advantage environment. But with the feds trying to move that down, one of the things that was noted in the lecture was that United, who has been chosen now, and most, I think most of my constituents will, not most, but many of my constituents will go to the United PPO, just laid off or ended their contracts with doctors all over the country. And one of the things that was said was that they have 98% coverage rate. Well, I heard this at this lecture completely by chance last night. I went in and Googled United Health, and indeed, all over the country, they've stopped their contracts under Medicare Advantage plans. Being that this is called Medicare Advantage, but it has to adhere to the state contract requirements, is that going to impact their network of doctors?
The network is irrelevant under the United plan because the member can go to anyone who accepts Medicare. As a general rule, however, I've seen those articles and we've seen that information as well. That is more of a function on the commercial individual plans than it is on the commercial group plans.
That's why I'm asking the questions, because
I understand,
it alarmed me in a quick Google search last night.
It alarmed me too. It
yielded all over. So we're here because of the state contract, correct? Whose idea was the Advantage program? Was that the administration?
It was a decision made during the master negotiations between both parties at the table.
Okay. So who put that on the table?
Senator, I don't know that I can give you a well-thought-out response on that.
I think in one of our previous hearings you had a response.
Did I?
Yeah.
Okay.
No comment today.
Well, if you can recollect for me, at the previous hearing in the spring, that was a little bit closer to the February the 28th finalization of the contract with the AFSCME.
Okay. So let's switch here to the procedure of this. And I'm a little fuzzy on Mr. Brown's role. Is Mr. Brown a policymaker, or is he here to ensure that the process is followed correctly?
Senator, I was not involved in the establishment of the policy. The legislation that was enacted and signed into law by the governor established the chief procurement officer to oversee the procurement related to this coverage, but the program individuals, the folks that are responsible for the policy side, are within the administration and Janice's shop. You know, they set that policy.
So this bid spec that went out that basically made it impossible for some people to qualify, that Senator Frerichs, Chairman Frerichs is referring to, about the needing to have 1,000 lives covered in private or 500 lives covered in a governmental entity, that bid spec came from the administration?
That's correct.
Okay. Did they consult you during that process?
Yes.
So if you are not a policymaker, why did they consult you?
Because as part of the procurement, that would have been one of the criteria set as a standard for all firms to be evaluated by. And our performance in this process was to make sure that all companies are evaluated by the same standard. So our questions were, okay, have you set a standard? The answer is yes. Next question, what is the standard? They've described the standard, you know, 1,000 lives here, 500 lives on the public side administered. And as I mentioned earlier, my next question was, that seems very, very low as it relates to how large our insured pool is. And what we discussed, again, is the consultation that CMS had with their team, with Siegel, about what
does the federal government certify people as Medicare Advantage programs?
I believe they do, but I would have to defer to the program.
So if you have a federally certified Medicare Advantage program, why do you need a separate spec?
Senator, I think that being federally certified to be involved in a Medicare Advantage program is different than providing the service to an identified constituency.
So if Health Alliance bid this contract and bid all 100-plus counties of Illinois, that wasn't good enough, but it is okay to award a contract to a company that only provides two counties in Illinois?
Senator, that wasn't a measurement that was used. There's not a comparison between whether they bid 102 counties or whether someone else bid two. That wasn't
right.
A,
that's
an
my point.
Factor.
I mean, this seems a bit asinine that you have this factor in there at all. I mean, if you have a company that's good enough for State Farm and Caterpillar to insure their employees, why on earth wouldn't it be good enough? And they bid a statewide contract, but this, you're not the policymaker. You're the policymaker. By the way, the governor was in my area last week and said this was your decision, Mr. Brown. Do you have any comment on that?
I understand that he made those comments. And the thing that I can establish for you today is that the programmatic responsibilities of administering these benefits are the administration's responsibility.
Okay. So, Janice.
Yes, sir.
This is your responsibility. This is the administration's decision.
Absolutely.
You have a company that bid statewide that was knocked out before it ever bid based upon the specs you put into the deal, into the RFP. Why did you put those specs in there?
Because we think those thresholds were reasonable based upon the size of the procurement we were doing.
So at the end of the day, okay, let's talk about reasonable. Because at the end of the day, for the taxpayers to get a good deal, you have to have a healthy pool of bidders, correct?
Correct.
And they have to bid here and bid there, and eventually you get the lowest bid, and then the taxpayers get the most bang for their buck, right? That's kind of the theory here.
Yes, sir.
Today's News Gazette says that Health Alliance, who was out before they even bid under your specs, bid anywhere from 24 to 124% less than the winning bidders. Now, I don't care what your rationale and reasoning was for your bid specs. You're telling me now, today, and this is how it sounds to me, and I think most of my constituents, you're telling me that your bid specs took a company and you deemed it wasn't worthy, despite the fact that Caterpillar, State Farm, dozens of governments around the state of Illinois, I believe the city of Champaign has them, for Medicare Advantage. The federal government says they're okay for Medicare Advantage. Bid the entire state of Illinois, but because they didn't have enough people in their initial pool, we're going to throw them out before even scoring them, even though at the end of the day, they're 24 to 124% cheaper.
I think the winning ones would have been 125, 124% greater.
Right. They're cheaper.
They're cheaper. I don't think
the point is you've got a process that knocks them out before you even score them, and at the end of the day, the taxpayers, you have a Medicare Advantage opportunity to save money. The taxpayers have a right to those savings. Could you have gotten more savings without that requirement, one, which you put in there on behalf of the administration, which you, Mr. Brown, could have waived but refused to waive, which I find, by the way, you can say you're not a policymaker. The minute you refused to waive it, you became a policymaker. They're out, and then the procedure gets even more interesting. You file a request to get the information to file a protest, so you're the company. You file a request for information so you can file your protest. The administration says, oh, we're going to need more time on that, and conveniently waits out the period of the protest to file. They request from you, Mr. Brown, an extension of time, citing, hey, we don't have the right information back yet to actually file or even decide if we want to file a protest. You deny their extension of time, and then conveniently after their extension of time is denied, the administration gives them what they need to file with. And by the way, this commission here asked on October 3rd for the documents that we got when? Yesterday. Now, what am I to take from all this?
Under the procurement code and the procurement process, there are certain steps that we are required by the law to follow. So to a point that you made some time ago regarding the lack of information being put out, as you can well imagine, as we've been through before in front of this commission, from the moment the award is announced until the dispute period or protest period is exhausted, the hands of the agency running the procurement are tied. So in the first week, there were multiple messages put out by Health Alliance regarding this procurement and what did or did not happen. My recollection is the first response put out was, we have no idea why we weren't chosen. The second response was, it was a mere technicality. And the third response was, we didn't meet the minimum mandatory requirements. Health Alliance was advised before Labor Day that they did not meet the minimum mandatory requirements on this procurement.
And they asked for a waiver. Correct.
Not of me, sir.
But they, from him?
Yes.
And under the procurement, there is an opportunity for a potential bidder to ask for a waiver, to ask for the specifications to be modified or to challenge those specs. That is standard language in any procurement that we do. And the bidder has 7 days from the release of the procurement to make that challenge. No such challenge was made. There were two separate communications from my office back out to Health Alliance in an effort to resolve whether or not these specifications could be or were met by Health Alliance. The first was sent to Health Alliance on July 23rd, and it requested that they explain to us how they met the specs. And with response to the HMO product, which we are focused on, the response was, Health Alliance serves 107 employer groups, including public sector groups. When you combine the totals for all government groups, we meet those requirements. To your comments, sir, regarding State Farm and Caterpillar, that is not a separate independent contract with those companies in Health Alliance. Health Alliance is simply one of many vendors that can be accessed by their employees on a Medicare exchange.
That's the point.
There is no Medicare exchange, sir, for the state of Illinois.
I guess what I'm saying to you is, if it's good enough for them, what's the problem? But look, there's a lot of people who want to ask questions. I'll simply conclude with, you have a process that from the beginning looks like it was set up to exclude a company from bidding. At the end of the day, we find out today that they would have been the cheapest bidder if they'd been included. In the meantime, my constituents will be going to the PPO through United, and guess what? The taxpayers are going to pay more than they would have otherwise paid in the HMO. I mean, they're all HMO Health Alliance people now. Well, now they're going to go to PPO, and they're still going to go to Carl or wherever they're going to go, but the hip surgery that they get is going to cost the taxpayers more, and them, I might add, because now they're on a 10% coinsurance. I find this absolutely baffling that this is the level of service commitment we have out of this. After the number of questions that have happened over the last 2 years about this committee, we find out yesterday that we get the documents back. I mean, frankly, I think we ought to have substantive committees of the House and the Senate convene with subpoena power and put you guys under oath.
We hold the applause and the comments. Do you have any response to that?
No, sir.
Do you have any idea how much money could have been saved if the bid that wasn't considered had been awarded?
Under the procurement code, once a bidder is excluded from the procurement, the agency has no authority to open the technical specs or the pricing specs of that procurement. Those documents certainly simply aren't looked at by the agency running the bid.
Are those documents available for the public? I mean, in the interest of transparency here? I mean, so then how is this information released? I mean, I realize we want to have procurement reform. We want to make sure things are done right, but we also should make transparency part of our legislative process as well.
Senator, documents are certainly available, and the analysis that, and I believe that this is the basis for the analysis that's before you. Health Alliance has the opportunity to compare their own numbers against those numbers that were awarded and those numbers that they sought information on. So they certainly had those numbers available for their analysis. Now, as far as any member of the public, all these documents are public. Now, one of the circumstances that does exist within the frame of insurance company bids is that the companies, and I believe all companies, have expressed the requirement to redact the formulas by which they arrive at their final computations, because okay, those are proprietary. Those end numbers are certainly available.
Taxpayers could be saving. And you say that you haven't looked at that, don't care to look at that, can't look at that.
We don't, as a matter of practice, we don't evaluate disqualified bids. We don't take them through to the end of the process. Even if we had, we would have to take, we would essentially, what we would do in normal circumstances is rebid. We would cancel everything and start over if we were to find something so anomalous. But this circumstance is not uncommon. We have bidders who are disqualified for a number of compliance reasons, and that represents their inability to obtain the contract, not whether they have some good business rationale or not.
So under procurement reform, your main goal is to make sure we meet technical requirements. You have no interest in looking at savings to the state. That's not something to consider?
The charge of the state's chief procurement officer is not to come in and second guess, not to set the code aside, not to set the competitive requirements aside that establish equivalency and evaluation. Because we could go to virtually every procurement and say, if your price is low enough, we'll set aside the laws of the state. That would be an inappropriate action on my part.
Sure, well, we indiscriminately set them aside, but we do have the ability to grant waivers. In previous procurements, we have granted waivers, have we not?
No, that provision is not afforded in our standard procurement process. This particular transaction, as authorized by law, prescribed the chief procurement officer's ability to waive requirements. What that represents for me, Senator, is the ability to establish a process, wave off of those procedures that we established in the procurement code, and that those are the law of the land. I get to set as many of those aside as necessary to follow this truncated process.
Okay. We could have set some of those aside. We could have some waivers. We just chose not to. You chose not to.
That's correct.
Okay. I'm a little confused, but hopefully my colleagues who have questions will help provide some clarity. First, Co-Chair Tracy.
Thank you. I hope that I've not repeated anything, and we've skipped kind of back and forth, and so I'll try to wrap up my comments. The first that comes to mind is a colleague mentioned to me that in light that our constituents have been surprised by some of the mailings and then bringing them to our attention, would it be possible within the CMS procedures to give us copies? We get copies of CMS materials all the time, but when we do something of this magnitude, would it be possible that at the forefront, when these things are mailed out, could the General Assembly also be given that information at the time it's sent out to the recipients?
My office provides those to our internal Office of Governmental Affairs for sharing with the staffers of the General Assembly.
So So could we be included in that instead?
I will talk to my Governmental Affairs office, but yes, ma'am, I do share that information so it can be passed to the members of the General Assembly.
Okay. Well, it certainly would have been helpful if we'd had some of this at the forefront. Going back to when we were talking about the discretion of waivers, and Matt, I think you said that you were the one that made that, so it was your discretion, your sole discretion, not to accept any of the waivers, like, for instance, the one asked by Health Alliance.
That's correct.
So that is actually kind of a policy decision, isn't it?
Well, I wouldn't say it's a policy decision based on the establishment of that threshold. It's a procurement decision based on whether or not that procurement requirement remains or is relieved. So, again, there was no policy consideration on my part whether or not Health Alliance met or didn't meet that caused me to make a decision. That wasn't part of the decision-making process. It was a question of, is this an appropriate threshold to measure all of the bidders by? The party requesting the waiver certainly would have been the immediate beneficiary of the waiver, but the waiver in effect qualifies for everyone, not just Health Alliance.
Okay.
I'm sorry. Sure, they would have immediately benefited, but if they were more expensive than the other people, they wouldn't have received the bid, they wouldn't have benefited then.
I have no disagreement with that.
Okay.
No, that's fine, because I appreciate the clarification, because I was one other question that comes to mind in all of this is it my understanding that we still have a 30-day window from this point of this hearing and now to solidify these contracts? At this point in time, they are not solidified, correct?
Janice?
I can respond to that. With the procurement, the legislation that was passed with regard to this procurement, the 30-day period for the commission exists under Section 375/5, little 3, which indicates, except as otherwise provided in this item number 3, no contract subject to this section may be entered into until the 30-day described in item 2 has expired, unless the director requests in writing that the commission waive the period. This item 3 does not apply to any contract entered into after the effective date of this amendatory act of the 98th General Assembly and through January 1, 2014 to provide a program of group health benefits for Medicare primary members and their Medicare primary dependents. So the 30-day waiver policy that ordinarily applies for group health contracts is specifically excluded from this contract.
Chapin, did you have another question that you want to follow up on?
Just a quick follow-up for Mr. Brown. So you get to, you have the discretion of this protest period. Do you think it makes sense to have a timeline where people have to protest before they're given the information that they need in order to protest?
At the outset of this procurement, we established the protest period would run for 7 days. This procurement was under a truncated timeline established by the enabling law, and we set that out initially in this procurement. Now, from a...
But do you think it makes sense? I mean, you're the guy that's in charge of this.
So...
Do you think that makes sense?
Establishing the window, I think it makes sense. The question...
I think your specific question
is where can they get information in order to file a protest in a timely manner?
Decide whether they want to file a protest in a timely manner.
Yeah. But we noticed on October 1st, we noticed the award to the vendors that Janice described earlier. Providing the information to Health Alliance is part and parcel to their request. You know, they made the request of CMS.
And CMS conveniently didn't get back to them until after the protest period was over. My question to you is, do you think that's fair, yes or no?
Senator, I don't want to speak to fairness in
it's
CMS.
It's a simple question.
Senator, I don't want to speak to fairness in the actions that CMS took in engaging requests from Health Alliance. The information that we put forward in the award included the kind of information to set this process forward. That is and the 7 days was established up front. That is a fair process. I can't speak to the amount of effort or design that that a potential protester would want to go through. I can't speak to that.
Okay.
Following up, you know, back on the question when we said that it Health Alliance bid coming in somewhat lower, I know that you mentioned that the procurement code process doesn't require you to analyze that, but surely human nature and the fact that we all work for the taxpayers of the state of Illinois would have set some wheels rolling that this plan is actually cheaper and could save some money if people chose to go with that plan. Did that not occur to you?
That doesn't occur in any procurement we conduct in this jurisdiction or others. And that's not a procurement code issue. That's not an order of the law of our land. That's procurement practice in most jurisdictions.
I'm just on the personal side of it. Didn't a light bulb maybe go off and say, wow, that could save some money?
From our perspective, no. I mean, we don't go that far with the analysis.
Okay. Going back to the people that got these mailings, what happens if they don't sign up to do that or do a recertification of an audit? Take them separately. What happens if a person doesn't sign up for one of these plans?
They lose their coverage effective February the 1st under the state plan.
So they wouldn't fall back on the existing Medicare supplement plan? They just totally would be out on their own, out of the coverage of the state retirement systems?
That's correct.
Is there going to be any follow-up if you don't get their stuff back, or you just write them off?
There'll be follow-up. We have the original letters that went out this week. There will be a reminder postcard sent to members that tells them that the open enrollment period is coming. It runs November the 12th into December the 13th. There will be a 16-page enrollment kit that goes out from CMS along with an enrollment form. Along with a schedule of seminars that goes out to members before the November 12th date. There will be another mailing to members between November the 12th and December the 13th that reminds them that enrollment period is almost ending. And although not yet finalized, there will likely be another mailing in January to those members who simply did not send us a form to say we did not get your form. If you intend to stay enrolled with the state plan, we need information of you regarding your choice for the Medicare Advantage product.
Do you know what date that is? Is it before or after the cutoff?
In January, it'll be after December the 13th, but before February the 1st.
Okay.
Because we won't know until we get the enrollments in the target audience for that last mailing.
Does United have a Medicare Advantage PPO in every state or even a country where the retirees reside?
They have a nationwide PPO. A Medicare Advantage PPO isn't available in a foreign country. If a member has a foreign country address, they're excluded from the members that are impacted by this procurement.
So So you're saying that as far as in within the national network, that there is in every state a going to be a Medicare Advantage offering?
There's access to the PPO contract, the PPO plan in every state, yes.
Do we know how prevalent the providers are in every state?
It is irrelevant under the PPO plan. The provider doesn't have to be in the network in order for the member to access the benefit.
Well, I do think we probably have a lot of retirees living in the state of Florida, for example, and it's interesting that they've already sent me copies of what is appearing on their doctor's doors in Florida that say, we do not accept Medicare Advantage or AARP replacement plans.
I've been advised that those are with respect to the individual Medicare Advantage plans, not the group market PPO plans.
So our people don't need to be worried about that?
Your people, your constituents, to the extent that they live in Florida, can access any, can go to any doctor as long as they accept Medicare and be covered under the Medicare Advantage group PPO plan.
You know, we got word from our local provider at Blessing Hospital that one of the people that works with these said that they had contacted United Healthcare and that they were informed that United Healthcare would only be a deemed provider. Can you tell me what that is?
No, but I can ask United Healthcare to join me at the table and they can respond to your question if that is all right with the commission.
What this person said to me that they asked United Healthcare if they had led the state to believe that they had a full network within the state of Illinois and that actually they really don't.
The issue, again, under the PPO plan, the issue of the existence of or non-existence of a network for purposes of access for the member to the benefits is not relevant. The provider and the hospital do not have to be in the PPO network in order for the member to access care from that provider. The provider need only be a Medicare-eligible provider in order for the member to seek services from that provider.
You can see why the constituents that we have are greatly concerned when they get answers like this.
I can, ma'am, but let me give one example. I was in Champaign, Urbana on Sunday. I spent approximately 4 hours with, I would estimate, somewhere between 500 and 600 SUAA annuitants, State Universities Annuitants Association members, on this particular issue. And I can tell you at the start of that meeting, the representatives from SUAA, not the representatives from my office, the representatives from SUAA stood up and said, for those of you who are concerned about Carle Hospital, to Senator Rose's point earlier, they've assured us they'll bill United as an out-of-network provider. So to the same point here with Blessing, they can either choose to send the bills to United Healthcare as an out-of-network provider, or they can choose not to. The only way the member doesn't have access to that doctor is if the doctor chooses not to see the member. Not that the doctor chooses not to send the bill to United, but merely that the doctor chooses not to see the member. I've spoken to Carle on a number of occasions. I have not spoken to Blessing. I've actually asked my contractors not to have conversations with these hospitals until we could address the concerns raised by this commission.
Could we ask United
Absolutely.
To explain what that deemed provider designation means?
Good morning, I'm John Thompson with United Healthcare. And a deemed provider basically would be a provider where we pay 100% of the Medicare allowable. So we are paying the same as traditional Medicare would pay. There would be no difference for a retiree going to that provider under traditional Medicare as they would under the United Healthcare Group Medicare Advantage PPO.
So if you are going to Janice's point, then within the PPO, a doctor could opt not to take the patient because they have concerns about the payment process.
So most doctors and facilities nationwide will accept the United Healthcare Group Medicare Advantage PPO because we're paying the same as Medicare pays. And we actually will pay the provider quicker than traditional Medicare. So the majority of providers nationwide accept this plan because they know they're going to be paid the same as the Medicare allowable, the same as traditional Medicare, and they're going to be paid faster than they would under traditional Medicare.
Thank you.
Can I say one just follow-up question? If hospitals are required to take Medicare, so they don't have a choice, if the physician is in an integrated system and the physician is working for that hospital, that physician, even if they wanted to, they don't have a choice to say we're not going to take Medicare patients if they're part of that integrated system?
It would depend on that physician and their contract with the facility. Again, we would pay the facility or the provider, if they're non-contracted, 100% of the Medicare allowable, the same as traditional Medicare.
Okay, so if you work for the hospital, that you had to follow the hospital federal guidelines regarding having to take Medicare. But in this case, the only issue would be if you had some independent specialist who said they weren't going to take Medicare, that would be a problem with any provider.
The key would be, for instance, if a provider has opted out of the Medicare program. So again,
right.
There's different ways. Even if the provider does not accept assignment, they would be covered under the plan. But if a provider has opted out of Medicare in its entirety, they would not be covered. To my knowledge, that's the same how it would currently work under the current program.
That's okay. Right. Thank you, Chair Tracy.
Thank you. Going back to when we were talking about reserves and the TRIP and the SIP programs and talking about the lower premiums there, I had a question in my mind that did I understand you to say that TRIP and SIP programs actually have cash reserves?
No, ma'am. They have deficits.
Right. And so their premiums are actually going to be lower.
Yes, ma'am.
And I'm just trying to figure out how that works. How are we going to keep that solvent?
It works because the law says the cost charge of the employees is based upon the cost charge of the members is based upon a percentage of the total cost of the plan. So because the total cost of the premiums have reduced significantly, then the cost to the employees or to the retirees for their premium payment has reduced significantly. So under the law, enrollees in TRIP as members, the fund covers 75% of the cost, and the member covers 25%. So they're paying 25% of what 100% of the cost is under the plans that are being offered. They are simply significantly lower than the current plans. The same is true for SIP. The plan pays 75, the member pays 25, except for the dependent. The dependent in SIP, the plan pays 100% of the cost.
But we do have concerns about the reserves and pushover for the payments. I mean, obviously, at some point, we're going to run into a huge problem.
Obviously, I do not disagree with you, ma'am. Not at all.
Thank you.
Representative Pope.
Thank you. I guess probably most of my calls I'm getting in my office, they've paid into Medicare 30, 40 years, and they want to stay in the Medicare program. But you're telling me that February 1st, if they want to stay in the Medicare program with the federal government, they're thrown out of the state part. Is that what you said?
They would have to opt out of the state plan if they want to stay in traditional Medicare, yes, sir.
So basically, this has taken the place of the federal government, and the state's going to actually manage it for them for a fee.
The private insurer is going to manage the Medicare piece.
So basically, CMS, Governor Quinn, you've made a decision that person's paid Medicare for 40 years. He worked for the state. I got a guy here, he worked for the state 39 years. But if he wants to stay with Medicare, you're going to throw him out of the state system.
He's still getting coverage just like he is under traditional Medicare, because the Medicare Advantage plans, as we're just testified to, cover based upon traditional Medicare rates. The only difference is rather than paying into Medicare and having Medicare reimburse the provider, the private plan reimburses the provider.
You probably got to understand there's a lot of people out there who don't really trust government. And what we're doing is we're moving them out of a comfort zone into a whole new program. And they're really uncomfortable about that because they've had good luck. And there's a lot of things they're worried about is that keeping that doctor. Maybe you don't think that there's going to be signs up that we don't accept Medicare Advantage. But guess what's going to happen? So then we got these seniors who are going to have to start looking for new doctors and those kind of things. So that's a concern. Just a few questions real quick. The 1% already kicked in for the seniors. They get that 1% again next year, right, on the retirement?
The retirement,
on their, insurance.
The rates for retirees are scheduled to increase on July 1. Currently, they're 2% for non-Medicare, 1% for Medicare. They're scheduled under the union contract under the group health rules to increase to 4% and 2% respectively on
right.
July 1.
Okay, what about, we got quality care now. That is gone. If you're out of state, that was, people paid extra for that.
It is not gone if you're out of state. It is not available to individuals who are Medicare A and B primary and who, if they have dependents, are Medicare A and B primary as well.
Quality care is still available.
For a retiree who's out of state who isn't Medicare, quality care is still available, as are the open access plans.
But if he's on Medicare, he has to go to Medicare Advantage.
Correct.
And, well, for example, I've paid extra for quality care for 20 years just for that ability to go what doctor I want to go to, those kind of things. Probably you're going to lose that under Medicare Advantage, right?
No, sir, not on the PPO plan. You're able to see any doctor you want to see under the Medicare.
Take it.
As was just explained, that is an individual Medicare Advantage market
right.
plan. This is not an individual plan. This is a group Medicare Advantage plan. It is not an individual. I signed up to go to AARP and bought an individual plan based upon my own individual health care. This is a group plan.
So I can tell my constituents this is a plan put out by the governor of the state of Illinois. I don't know one legislator. We didn't vote for this, right? Or does that bill give you the right that we actually voted for it?
You voted for the procurement change in the Group Insurance Act last spring.
I don't know
if anyone on this commission voted in favor of it, but it was passed through both houses of the General Assembly.
Yeah. So this isn't a CMS decision. I know she didn't come back and get permission before you did it, so maybe we should have done that. Just one other thing real quick. Senator Stevenson said that if you go out of a network, and then the state is going to pick that up, right?
Correct.
Okay, so whenever you're projecting your savings, that's going to dip into your savings that you're projecting, right?
No.
You're expecting $300 million savings, right? And then you said that?
The costs of the plan are significantly lower. That's what I'm paying a premium to a fully insured vendor.
But if they stay in plan, it's going to be cheaper because you're not going to be, are you going to be paying the same amount?
I'm going to be paying the same amount to United Healthcare and Coventry Advantra and Humana. I pay a per member amount to them. They're fully insured. If the cost of the plan is more than I'm paying them, they bear that risk. They're a fully insured product. Just like our HMO products right now, I pay them a certain flat fee per member per month, and if the claims exceed that amount, that risk is borne by the carrier, not by the state.
State.
It's fully insured.
Okay. Just one more quickly. If I pay the 1% that kicked in this year, the 1% next year, on an average, how much more did that cost the retiree on their insurance? They're part of the premium.
It's absolutely based upon the amount of the annuity.
Yeah,
the
I knew that. I didn't
know
if you had an average or.
I don't, but I can tell you that because the premiums are so much lower, although I know there's a lot of people in the lower groups, I have a number of retirees who have significant annuities. And at some point, their 1% or 2% may well exceed the current cost of premium under these plans. So they'll actually see their costs go down because they obviously can't be charged more than 100% of the cost of the plan.
Go ahead.
So, okay, this is very interesting. So what you're saying is the people with the significant annuities who have money to burn under what just happened here are going to pay less, but the people with insignificant annuities who don't have money to pay burn, money to burn, could pay more.
They're not going to pay less, but I certainly couldn't sit before this commission and tell you that I'm going to charge someone more than 100% of what a plan costs me.
Right, but... the issue here is not Medicare Advantage, because I think there's demonstrated cost savings from Medicare Advantage as a tool. And to the United guy that was up here a minute ago, if you're an out-of-state retiree who's waiting 11, 12, 13 months to get your claims paid, in the meantime you've paid out of pocket, this will help you. The issue is whether these guys got it right in issuing the contracts for networks and whether or not they actually got to the point where they got the state actually covered in a cheaper way. And so if your savings to Medicare Advantage is here, had you left Health Alliance in this bidding pool rather than write them out on the front end, could you have netted even more savings for the taxpayers, because now that hip replacement will be in an HMO-controlled cost as opposed to an a PPO cost, which stands to reason is higher generally. That's the issue. But the Medicare Advantage, and I think Ms. Bonneville is correct in this, does yield savings. The question is, could we have saved a heck of a lot more for the taxpayers by getting it right the first time and who were inviting the bid?
Last question is on verification of dependents. I think maybe it was a misinterpretation from, because we got as many calls on that verification as we did about the Advantage program. Was your intent for everybody to provide every bit of information on every question, or was it just one would qualify you to show that you're a dependent?
As a general rule for each of the dependents, I believe that two forms of proof are required. So, for instance, for a spouse, you're required to produce both a copy of the federal transcript of your tax return as well as an additional document that shows you reside in the same household. For children, because under the age of 26, they are presumed by law to be a dependent for purposes of health care, there wasn't a federal tax return requirement, but there is a birth certificate requirement or adoption certificate requirement.
Did you want the whole form or just up at the top?
I just need the top, sir.
And that was a misinterpretation of our people. They thought, why do they want to know our whole tax?
Frequently asked questions clearly indicate that all of that information can be blacked out
right.
on the forms.
But I think maybe there's a way we can do that a little better next time, because there's a lot of confusion out there. And they thought they had to go right down the line and give you everything. And they're wondering why do they want to care if my house is paid for? Just all kind of things. But I think that's something in the future that we could clarify and make that a lot easier.
Understood, sir.
I know a lot of concerns about that. Senator Kaler, and then we'll go to Representative Tryon.
Yes, just a couple areas of questions. So first of all, I understand how the Advantage plan works. It covers both Part A and Part B. Is that correct?
Yes, correct, sir. Okay. And Part D.
And Part D, okay. The question I have is, just help me understand, how do they make their money? Is it... do they have contracts like they would have with PPO hospitals that they get reimbursed? They pay a different rate, or is it just a straight Medicare rate?
If the hospital is in network, I'm assuming you're talking about the PPO.
Right,
the HMO
yeah.
obviously only works within the network.
Right.
But for the PPO, if it's in network, then yes, it could be a different contracted rate. But the plans are also then reimbursed from the federal government based upon the money that's paid in by the member for their Medicare coverage.
Okay, so I'm just trying to figure out how they make money out of this deal, because we're paying a third party to basically run a Medicare program. So they're charging basically a premium for the Part D and Part B.
They're charging a premium for the coverage that they're providing.
Right.
So there's a premium paid by us. Then there's the premium that's paid in the federal Medicare that's reimbursed back to that plan.
Okay. So, I'm just trying to think, they've got to be making money out of this, because that's the point of being in this business. So where do they make their money in terms of how they administer this program? I'm just looking at general things.
They can deliver it cheaper than what Medicare can. So Medicare sends them a check, but they can do it cheaper than what Medicare can.
That's what I'm asking. Yes. So that's how they make their money.
Yes, sir.
Okay. The part that we started some questioning about here was in terms of the bidding criteria. Would you explain to me just exactly what it means to have an employer with a minimum of 1,000 participants or a government employer with 500? What does that mean?
It's the covered lives under the plan.
And why is that important?
That was the threshold that we set to say that it would be reasonable in our minds for the bidders on these plans to be able to carry that kind, given the fact that we're asking for coverage for 128,000 lives.
And
will again reiterate that we had 5 HMO bids. 4 of those bidders were able to meet that threshold.
Okay, but I guess why is that threshold important? In order to follow Senator Rose's questioning, they have to be certified as Medicare Advantage plans?
That's correct.
Okay, so why is this threshold important in that scheme?
It was the minimum requirements that we believed were necessary to be able to ensure that we had a provider who could manage this plan for our base of constituents.
But how would this threshold prove that?
You're not trying to bring in a provider who uses a small market. So we set minimum mandatories in all of our bids, and they're always based upon the overall scope of our design. I don't need a vendor in who says, well, yeah, I manage this for the township, so I can do it for the state.
Well, I guess I'm questioning whether that criteria is the right criteria, because I understand your point. You want somebody that has the capacity of being able to provide the service. But there's different ways of measuring capacity. I mean, you can look at a provider and say, okay, they have this book of business and they're involved in these kinds of programs, and so their capacity can be demonstrated. It seems to me that this is arbitrary, especially when we're not, you've made it very clear that having a PPO contract has no bearing on the kind of coverage or the access that a person under this plan would have. No bearing whatsoever. If it's a PPO hospital, that's fine, but if it's not, that's fine too. As long as they accept Medicare, that's the only criteria. So it seems to me that having this other minimum requirements is really not asking the right question. The question is, do they have the capacity to be able to deliver the service that we're expecting? That's the question.
Well, but there were two very different standards for the PPO and the HMO. The PPO contract standard was huge, as was the Medicare supplement standard. So the HMO standard was significantly lower. Again,
all I'm suggesting is that you asked the wrong question. That the standard that was created was not really pertinent to this. That the real question is, do they have the capacity?
And how do you ask the capacity question if you don't set a minimum standard?
Well, you can set a minimum standard in a lot of other ways. You can say what is your full book of business, how long have you been in business.
But the Medicare Advantage product is a different product than a standard commercial HMO book of business.
Are they certified as a Medicare Advantage plan?
That question's asked.
Okay. Then why, and do they have the capacity as a system to demonstrate that they've been in business for so many years, that they have so many covered lives, that they have provided certain services? If they have if they are certified as a Medicare Advantage plan and they have demonstrated capacity as a health system, then what else do we need to ask?
We asked specifically what you're suggesting. We asked that capacity question. That was the question that was asked, was do you have the capacity to handle this, and can you show us in your business that you've handled this capacity for this kind of product?
Well, I guess what I'm questioning is whether that threshold was the correct threshold.
Understood.
Yeah. Thank you, Representative Keeler. Representative Fryon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Janice, I mean, I think the questioning here, most of my questions have been answered with questioning by Senator Rose. But I would like to look at, you had a consultant that you engaged, right, on this process?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so your consultant's role was what?
To assist us in ensuring that the RFP was designed to ask the questions specific to this kind of product. This is a new product, obviously, for the state of Illinois, to make sure we're asking the right kinds of questions for this product so that we get the bids that we're looking for. We get the players brought into the bidding process, so we're not acting to and bring in those. They also assisted us with comparisons and analytics on this contract to make sure that we met our requirements to say that we were bringing in a plan that was consistent with the plan as it currently exists for the members.
So your consultant then, when you look at the plan and you look at the fact that today, if we go forward with what your decision is, that 40 counties now won't have a HMO option?
48.
48 counties don't have an HMO option. So my question is, based on the usage rate of HMO in those 48 counties, what's that going to cost off of this $200 million savings that you have? Because it's obviously going to cost more money.
Well, if you look at the rates, you actually have one HMO contract that is a lower rate than the PPO contract and one HMO contract that's a higher rate than the PPO contract. So depending on the choice the member makes, the savings is based upon a combination of those three, not on any one product.
So you're saying in the 48 counties that aren't going to have HMO product, the PPO was the cheaper solution?
The rate for the PPO is cheaper right now than the rate either that the state pays at 100% of the cost for the quality care plan within the state, or the blended rate of the HMO products currently paid for in the state.
So the fact that there's not an HMO in those 48 counties isn't a cost factor to consider in the savings, because you're saying the HMO would cost more.
The savings are based upon what the state pays right now. So I don't know what you have, and there was a plethora of information sent, but when you look, the easiest way to think about it is to look at the 100% rates. So in the annual report that COGPA sends out, and they put the rates, we have a rate for Medicare-eligible retirees. I believe in the HMO plan right now, a Medicare-eligible retiree, if they were to pay 100% of the cost, it would be somewhere just under $400. Under this plan, under the PPO, the 100% cost is around $180.
To the individual?
Well, it's 100% cost, so the individual plays a part or we pay a part. So that's the total cost of the premium being paid to the provider, being paid to the carrier. That savings is the difference between the almost $400 100% rate and the $180 100% rate.
And that's per month, correct?
Per month. Per member per month.
All right. So we the decision is we're just not going to have HMOs down there in 48 counties, basically. So
correct.
So if you're used to that, you're changing providers.
Well, you're not changing providers. You're already accessing a provider who takes Medicare because you're a Medicare member. Under the PPO, you can still go to that same provider. So it's kind of interesting, and I know that there were discussions in the spring session about this issue. So I have three providers available to the member. In the PPO world, the member's just picking a different carrier. Their provider doesn't change. They don't have to raise their hand and say, this is the doctor I want to see. They don't have to ask permission to see that doctor. They just go because the doctor takes Medicare and it's handled as a PPO plan.
Okay, so I understand all that. So let me ask you this. During this process, I mean, you're looking at the largest provider of HMO services in this part of the state not being accepted as qualified for the Medicaid Advantage plan, which I find odd, okay, because they're already delivering health care services. They're already certified by the federal government and by federal CMS to do that. To exclude them from this, I don't understand it. I mean, and to then find out today in the paper that their bid would have been substantially cheaper than some of the other ones, in that process, would that have come up with your consultants at all, that they would have been qualified?
No.
They still thought that 1,000 members had to be a safeguard for the state?
That it was a reasonable threshold to set.
So you say, I don't want somebody who just does these services for a township to be able to come in and say, I can do the state. But my guess is somebody that just did this kind of service for a township wouldn't be federally certified by CMS.
Of course they would. They'd have to be if they offer a Medicare Advantage plan. No, they cannot offer it without being certified by federal CMS. There are so many steps that are gone through for this. But to your other point, I have no issue. I have no concern and would never begin to argue with this committee the ability or the inability of the Health Alliance to provide HMO services for the population they currently provide it for. But with respect to the Medicare Advantage product, which they themselves say, if you take all of our books and combine them all together, we meet the threshold. That is not the question.
So in your opinion,
asked.
They couldn't meet the, they couldn't provide this service in these 48 counties? It may make sense for the PPO option, but for the HMO option, at least in the 48 counties, I don't understand how you can say they couldn't provide this service.
I didn't review the specs or the pricing because they didn't meet the minimum mandatory threshold.
Okay, back to the FOIA request. I mean, the protest period being 7 days after the after the procurement was closed, and I mean, why did it? I mean, our FOIA period is 7 days, right? Is that correct? You have 7 days after you receive a Freedom of Information Act to respond?
That is correct.
All right. But the FOIA doesn't say you can't give it to them sooner, correct? I mean it would seem this is one of the problems I have with FOIA, especially on something that's relatively straightforward in a request. Why don't we just give it to them when they ask for it? I mean, why do you have to wait 7 days? I mean, it put them outside the ability to protest. Was there any consideration given to that time period?
The information was provided to the requester as soon as it was available to provide to them, and in fact, it was provided in two different pieces so that they weren't waiting on any portion of that request before they received all of the requests.
So you're saying they had the information they needed to protest and adequate time to protest?
I'm not saying that at all, but I also would point out to this commission that the bids were posted on October the 1st. At the moment that the bids were posted, the requester that made the FOIA request was fully aware of the reasons behind their disqualification for the bid, but it was not until October the 4th, three business days later, that a FOIA request was submitted.
After the protest period had started.
After the protest period had started.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you're. Would your consultant have given you any advice regarding Health Alliance's ability to provide services that may indicate that you could have waived that and it would have been, you know, an adequate decision so that you could have evaluated their cost against some of the other costs?
No.
So the consultant never said to you or to Mr. Brown that, you know, Health Alliance is a large HMO service provider in Southern Illinois and they're capable of providing these services, and you might want to waive that requirement so you could review the cost?
No.
Do we waive requirements like that on procurements from time to time?
No.
Never?
We do not.
Do we allow for any kind of alternative bid process, so if you can't meet the specifications on that, you can submit under the procurement an alternative proposal?
We do rely on what's called meets or exceeds criteria in some procurements. Those are oftentimes not in a request for proposal of this nature. Those are more for commodities type environments where they're trying to say, look, we've designed something. It looks a little bit different than what you're using today, but it is exactly the same in performance, and we want to prove that performance to you, so those opportunities are available in commodities. But RFPs are tested differently. Those are generally service-related, and so those are elements of, again, to this threshold, what is the potential level of service? On this particular threshold, I questioned whether it was high enough, irrespective of consultation that CMS may have had from their consultant or things that they have viewed. I questioned whether, you know, 1% or less than 1% of our covered population in this, you know, in this entire set of books represented enough experience and capacity at 1% and less than 1% of our covered lives to scale up this quickly, this fast. You know, that was a question that I put forward to Janice, and I said, are you sure that you have a comfort level with this? Because this is an emergent product in the marketplace. This is new, or newer as far as people adopting this as their policy. So my question was, are we safeguarded enough? That was the analysis that I put into it.
Well, I have seen procurements from the state on services that allow for an alternative bid process. I mean, I understand that by the time you score the RFP, your request for qualifications, right, that if they don't meet that, then you never get to see what the cost comparison was, correct?
Correct.
And neither would your consultant?
Correct.
So your consultant would have had no knowledge of that that Health Alliance could have been submitting a much cheaper proposal.
Correct.
Okay. So again, I can only say it. If you're not saying that you don't think that the Health Alliance was incapable of servicing that in the HMO counties, this kind of came up the last time. We just weren't, you know, I mean, we gave HMO contracts to providers that didn't provide HMO in a big part of the state. We just opted not to have an HMO offering there. So.
That was, first of all, a different bid, and second of all, a large part of the discussions at the time were whether or not that HMO provider really could give quality access in those counties. And so I have an HMO provider here who doesn't have a single plan that meets a $500 or $1,000 threshold, 1,000 member threshold, but yet they're able to meet that requirement according to the commission and I guess what their response has been, because I haven't seen their specs in all 102 counties, even though their combined total book of business is all they is what they have to have to meet the threshold of 1,000 lives.
Okay, no further questions. Representative Hayes, I think what we're going to do is we obviously have lots of questions still. I think we just reached some basic disagreements on whether certain bids should have been considered or not, and how much money they would have saved. But I want to make sure that everyone has a chance to ask some questions. And then we do have a couple of the people who requested to speak. I'd like to make sure they have a chance, because at 11 o'clock we've got another committee hearing that we'll need to be moving on. But we'll ask a few more questions here from a few more members. And then if you want to hang out for a little bit while we bring some people forward, we might have some time to come back. That works. Representative Hayes.
Thank you. Thank you for the members for allowing me to ask a couple of questions. I woke up the day after this was announced, and I thought I was oddly caught in some kind of a loop, a time warp from the movie Groundhog Day. My constituents baffled how this could possibly happen again. The senator made, I think, a very interesting observation in relation to, are we asking the right questions? And should these threshold not be capacity to deliver? It's a very interesting conversation when you talk to the staff person who you met in the hallway this morning, who was going to the same doctor who is in the state plan for many, many, many years, and now all of a sudden that health plan is excluded because of some unusual contortion that suggests they don't have the capacity to deliver. I mean, we're talking about Health Alliance as if there's some mom-and-pop shop that just got into to healthcare. They've been delivering services to the same people for most of their working lives. They haven't changed doctors. They just don't come into work in the morning anymore because they're retired. And now we're telling them that somehow the healthcare network, which, by the way, everybody acknowledges in counties like Champaign and Vermilion and Sangamon, the concentration where the flagship university of the state is located, where the overwhelming concentration of state workers are located. This is where these folks are. The unquestioned, most robust healthcare network is here. I don't think anybody disputes that. Yet, they're in the Medicaid Advantage program, certified, 4.5 stars. So the federal government says, not only are you certified, but here's the gold plate standard of how this should work. And then we find out that the punchline in all of this is, when finally the FOIA information is released for a state employee, Aetna, 24% higher than the Health Alliance bid, Humana Benefit, 120% higher, Humana Health Plan, 120 higher, 120%, United, 94% higher. So my constituents in Champaign and Vermilion County, huge concentration of retirees, their only real option is going to be this United plan, and the state of Illinois is going to pay 94% more per member per month. TRIP employees are going to pay 74% more per member per month. SIP employees were going to pay 74% more per member per month. Help me connect those dots with my constituents.
As we've indicated before, my staff neither look at the technical information nor the pricing. There was a specification in the original contract, a minimum mandatory requirement. The original RFP language indicated that any bidder who had any concern about the specs of the RFP as they were written had the right to challenge those specs within the first 7 days that RFP was posted. I will tell you that we posted no less than 12 addenda to this RFP. We had a vendor conference with all of the interested bidders present, and at no time during that conference or during those addendas was any challenge issued to our office or, to my knowledge, to the CPO's office regarding the specifications and the minimum mandatory threshold that was written into the RFP.
At some point, though, reasonably, do we put a company domiciled in the state of Illinois in this awkward position that they become the boy who cries wolf, because there seems to be a pattern of behavior that tries to exclude this company. And the last time around, and I'll tell you, the members of this commission, nothing short of heroic in Vermilion and Champaign counties. The Auditor General issues, I think, the most blistering audit report that I've ever seen in terms of the process the last time around. I have people asking me openly, when you go through this, and you go through it again, and you go through it again, and then you have kind of this weak RFP dynamic that somehow wedges out the most robust provider, not looking at capacity, as the senator suggested, but looking at some other criteria, I have people asking me openly, does this reek of a vendetta? Thank you.
No comments. Co-Chair Tracy.
One question I had is, we have a small segment of state retirees that are not Medicare eligible, and where do they fall within this plan?
This has absolutely no impact on them. They stay exactly where they are. This is a targeted group of retirees. The retiree, in order to be in the group of 128,000, the retiree and that retiree's entire enrolled household must be Medicare A and B. If that retiree or any member of that household is not Medicare A and B, they're in my other 375,000 lives. They're not impacted by this.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, I'm very interested in hearing from Linda Brookhart, but two of my colleagues insist they have very brief questions. Let's go first with Representative Tryon.
My question actually is for Dan Long. So what's our role here? When this is about self-insurance, we have a statutory role. So what's our role in this procurement?
Well, the commission has broad oversight authority under statute, oversight of the group insurance program, and our role here is to bring out and delight questions regarding this procurement, regarding the recertification process, regarding anything else that you'd like to discuss with regard to the
insurance.
We don't have a role in terms of approving a contract.
Right. So this is strictly going to be a decision made by CMS and the executive branch.
Right. We've already, and actually there's no self-insured contracts involved in this procurement anyway. So this is just
informational, more or less, on where we may want to go in the future.
This is to try to provide
statutory change or something.
Correct.
Thank you.
Yeah. And we still have oversight, and that's why we would expect when we have questions and the commission has questions, you know, we get answers in a somewhat timely manner and not necessarily given the same time that they're given out to the public. Senator Rose.
What was the who was the consultant that was hired for this?
Siegel was not hired for this procurement. The agency let an RFP last fall for consulting services, and contracts were awarded to both Siegel and Deloitte. The timing of those contracts were such that Siegel was the consultant available to assist us on the Medicare Advantage RFP. They have done this in multiple other states with the current providers that were selected and others, and have proved invaluable for us both in the front end of the RFP and now as we roll out the enrollment period.
Okay. Ms. Bonneville, you answered Mr. Representative Tryon in a very interesting way on a question he asked, and I just got to say this. You said something in effect of that you didn't for a minute doubt that Health Alliance was able to serve the people they currently serve, but that they had to cobble together all these things to meet the minimum bid spec.
The 1,000
and the 500 lives.
My comment was with respect to their current book of business that they provide to us as a commercial HMO provider, not as a Medicare Advantage HMO provider.
Understand that.
Okay.
Here's my point. Do you have any idea how ridiculous that sounds to my constituents? Because my constituents are those very same people. So if you, head of CMS procurement, says that they're very competent to serve the people they're serving, why on earth are we not letting them continue to serve them? A, but B, you've left money on the table. I mean, there's no doubt that Medicare Advantage saves money for the taxpayers, period. We had a big discussion on this. The out-of-state people with United, I think, will be much happier than they are right now with Cigna. But you've left money on the table, which gets back to Jill Tracy's point, to Mr. Brown, and Mike Ferks's point as chairman a minute ago. There's money left on the table, and at what point in time does a light bulb go off and say, huh, maybe we ought to rethink this? That's a comment, not a question.
Okay. We have a couple of more questions we want to get asked on the record before Linda Brookhart comes forward. But I just have one question. So this Medicare Advantage, is there a federal subsidy involved in this at all?
There's money that moves from the federal government to the carrier who is providing the Medicare coverage as a private insurer.
Okay, so the state has savings, but if that federal subsidy went away, would we continue to see those savings? So then this is not necessarily a question of the private sector beating the federal government. This is the private sector working with the federal government to get those savings.
Well, the private
correct?
Sector can do it less expensively than the federal government. There's also quite a bit more care management under a Medicare Advantage plan than there is under your traditional fee-for-service Medicare plan.
Okay, but they are doing this with federal government support. I have a few questions we want to ask on dependent certification, and then we'll move on to some other questions. Why do retirees need to recertify dependents? We started to ask this earlier.
Right. So the group that is currently receiving the dependent certification letters is a retiree population, but this isn't a targeted retiree population. Prior to 2003, no documentation was required to add a dependent to your group insurance program. You simply signed them up, you put their Social Security number down, and they were on. Prior to the increase of the age for dependent children to 26, first in the state and then at the federal level, we certified students twice a year in-house. That's a much smaller number, about 10,000 people. You're talking about 183,000 dependents on this plan. Everyone's concerned about cost. If I'm carrying dependents who aren't eligible for coverage, it's costing money to cover those dependents.
So is there a reason why this couldn't be done in-house, part of the benefits enrollment period?
It's simply too large. And we actually told retirees, we told everyone in May, in the benefit choice materials, both in the flyer and in the book online, that we were going to do a dependent audit. And if you have dependents on your plan who are ineligible for coverage, this is your opportunity to take them off.
Okay. I think we all agree here on the commission that we don't want to have fraud. Do you have any evidence of any fraud?
Only anecdotally. So I just had one the other day where the member has had his ex-wife on his plan since 2004 because members mistakenly believe that because the court says they have to provide their ex-spouse coverage that we do. We have the situation from just a few years back. I wasn't in front of this committee, but some of the members may recall who sat on the insurance committees where we changed the rules for survivors so that they weren't adding their newly acquired spouses because they are ineligible for coverage under our plan. If you have a member who dies, the state employee dies, the spouse becomes the member, and all of a sudden we're covering that deceased employee's spouse's new spouse and their new kids. So it is a tightening of the belt, so to speak, in an age where it seems that we're getting more and more pressure to provide coverage for anyone and everyone under a plan that simply can't sustain that cost.
Okay. So, but it's, I think it's fairly clear that we might need to do something here, but the process we're going through seems a bit cumbersome and is definitely confusing for some retirees. What happens to those retirees who are confused by the process and fail to submit the required information?
The ultimate decision to terminate or not terminate the dependent rests with CMS. So, for instance, I have in my office the list of terminations for the college and the local program, looking at threshold items, for instance, like the age of the retiree or their age of their dependents, to make a determination whether or not that individual would be able to recertify or has a need to recertify. Also to look at whether or not the individual sent in documents that were deemed to be not responsive versus didn't send in any documents at all. All of that data is being collected. And I believe it's known to this commission, but I will just point out that for the group that we're currently certifying, the majority of the issues we've had in-house, and I know you've had calls, have been surrounded the shutdown of the federal government. I will say, one, we extended the time till December the 6th, but two, I heard from no less than a dozen individuals at the meeting I had in Champaign-Urbana on Sunday that they went online and requested their IRS transcripts, and magically they received them even though the federal government was shut down because it's an automated process.
Okay. How was the audit company selected for dependent recertification?
Competitive procurement.
And how are they paid?
They are paid a per member cost with the understanding of language in the contract that they will be paid only if their savings equals or exceeds the cost. So if I don't save any money under the contract, HMS doesn't get paid.
Okay, and how long is the contract for?
3 years with extensions on that contract.
Okay. I want to thank you very much for taking the time to answer these questions. If you can be near in case we have some time. But I do want to make sure other people who wanted to speak today have an opportunity. Oh, Representative Nekritz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize. I had to run out to another committee meeting. It's my understanding that some of the questions surrounding TRIP and SIP have not been covered while I was out of the room. Is that accurate?
Well, it's possible that people have other questions. We've asked an awful lot of questions.
Well, did anybody cover? I don't want to cover ground that was covered while I was out of the room. So if we covered TRIP and SIP, then I won't ask any questions. Okay. So my understanding is that TRIP and SIP are included in this. What is the statutory authority or the authority under which that's done?
For TRIP, it's in Section 6.5G, and for SIP, it's in 6.9G. It's the director of CMS has the authority for the design for both of those programs.
Okay. So we have given you statutory authority over TRIP and SIP.
Yes, ma'am.
They're in very, very bad shape, especially SIP. What do we have plans for how will this impact their fiscal health?
It will to a certain extent, but we did have this conversation to a certain extent, and the largest problem we have with SIP is our inability to adjust the money that's coming in from sources other than the premiums being charged to the members. I don't think anyone in this commission will dispute that the current premiums for SIP, not the premiums under Medicare Advantage, the current premiums for SIP members are outstanding. I'll use that term. However, the statute is designed as such that the other three pieces of the pie, so the active, the community college districts, and the state piece, are locked at 0.5%. So there is no automatic increase. TRIP has automatic increase language in it, but SIP doesn't, and it simply can't keep up with the growth of the cost of healthcare. That plan is projected to be roughly 2 years in the hole by the end of fiscal year 14.
Right. Okay. And then my last question is, how do you handle the TRIP participants that are not Medicare eligible?
They're not impacted by the plan. Okay. They're not impacted by this change, just like the state plan. The member has to be Medicare Parts A and B primary, otherwise they're not impacted by the plan.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Representative Riley has not had a chance to ask any questions.
That's a quick question for you, and this is sort of general, but there's been a few things that have been said that are still hovering around in the ether. You mentioned that Medicare Advantage is going to save money. It's more efficient. Medicare Advantage is still one of the four types of Medicare generally.
Well, it's a combination. It compiles A, B, and D into that.
But A, B, C, and D.
Yes, sir.
And there's still that federal. You know, it's not like keep your government hands off my Medicare. It still has federal tentacles all through it.
Yes, sir, it does.
So can you give me just an idea on how this is going to be more cost, you know, efficient? What are the kinds of things that makes it more cost efficient?
Well, the private insurer has the ability to put in. Traditional Medicare is fee for service.
Mm-hmm.
Medicare is trying to make inroads into case management and care management, but they're simply not as good at that as a private insurer is.
Because
the private insurer does that in all of their books of business, because that's what saves the private insurer money. If you're a diabetic and you're non-compliant, it helps to save money if the private insurer is working with you to get you compliant, to get you case management, to get you nurse management. Where on the Medicare side, traditionally, it's just, well, we're just paying the diabetic bill, whether it's the insulin or it's the emergency room or whatever it may be. So it's case management and care management. There are nurse helplines. There are
I understand. I'm sort of trying to make a point.
Okay.
Because also history tells us that Medicare Advantage, maybe not the way we're going to run this system here, but that Medicare Advantage has had a lot of problems also, and cherry picking and other kinds of things. So, you know, so as not to let this very important problem that we're dealing with today get in some other debate about, you know, the federal government's ability to deliver health care, I just wanted to, you know, to make that point. It still is part of it. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you both very much. Linda. Okay. Kelly Burke, Representative Burke has also not asked any questions, so we'll give her one. And then, Linda, you are up next.
Some of my retired state employees who've contacted me about the verification just had a question as to why the contractor to do this work, they understand that you can't do it in-house, but why the contractor is an Indiana company? And was there no one in Illinois who could do this work?
There was no one in Illinois that could do this work. There is no absolute preference under the procurement code for an Illinois vendor. So HMS was the top vendor under the procurement, both technical and price. Ultimately, they were the number one bidder. So there is no absolute right. So that's why they won the contract. this is what they do for a living. That's what they do. They do have a small presence in Illinois. I won't pretend that that it's a large presence, but they do have a small presence up in the northern part of the state. But they have we're using their Indiana facility for the processing of the mailings. They have facilities across the U.S. We're just using the Indiana one.
Okay, and before you go, you would agree to get back to us, just want to give some sort of time frame for the deductible credits?
Oh, yes, sir. Absolutely. I have to have a conversation with my current providers.
Okay.
So,
general time frame. We won't hold you specifically to it, but
are you sure?
Within a week? Someone might mention it in a reference.
But then we have to have the solution reached before we go to open enrollment on November the 12th. So that decision has to be made before then, because the members are that's going to have to be information articulated to them in a frequently asked question. Okay?
Okay.
Within the next couple of weeks. Okay?
Okay.
Is that sufficient?
Yes, thank you.
Okay.
Linda, please come up while we still have no questions. And we also had one other member fill out a witness slip if they could begin to prepare themselves, Beverly Johns. Linda Brookhart, Executive Director of State University Annuitants Association. Floor is yours.
Good morning. Good morning, Senator Frerix, Representative Tracy, and members of the Commission. I didn't come to argue or complain. I'm just bringing forth some concerns. As you know, it's already been stated that I'm the Executive Director of the State University's Annuitants Association. SUA advocates for all of the individuals within the State University's retirement system. Today, I am here on behalf of those who are having to make a choice between enrolling in the state-sponsored Medicare Advantage plan or seeking a Medigap plan from the private sector. I should also go on record that our organization has been pretty much an opponent to these health care changes as they have been rolled out. Our first and foremost concern has been the short, might I add, extremely short amount of time that has been allotted to inform the state, community college, and teachers' Medicare health insurance population of the changes being made to their health insurance. For many, the ability to process these changes will be quite distressing. Many will need assistance, as you can well imagine. Since before the month of May, SUAA urged people to be aware of the changes coming, to be knowledgeable about Medigap insurance, and ask people to make sure they read and understand the state-sponsored Medicare Advantage plan before making any decision. With all of our attempts, we realize that we have only reached a small percentage of those who will be affected by this insurance change. There was an informal briefing this past Sunday at the iHotel in Champaign, hosted by the SUAA University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign chapter. Janice Bonneville, Deputy Director, CMS Bureau of Benefits, spoke to an audience of over 500 concerned retirees. The informational session went well as the Medicare Advantage plans were outlined. I repeat, outlined, because there are no visible plans available yet. We know they're coming, so we just kind of talk. We haven't actually seen anything. Many questions were answered, but since then, other concerns have been brought forward. These concerns are not just from those who are patients of Carl Clinic. These concerns now come from across the nation. Most people are not aware of or are confused by the information that these Medicare Advantage plans will only pay what Medicare pays. They have been used to everything being paid for them. There needs to be examples provided as to what the patient will now be responsible for, such as certain leggings, garments that are circulation necessitated and have always been covered by the current health insurance. There's other examples out there. In at least some of our places, doctors are the facility. There are facility fees for procedure and visits that do not seem to be covered. This needs to also be outlined and brought to the attention of people. There are doctors, clinics, and hospitals throughout the nation and some in state that say that they will not accept United Healthcare in any way, shape, or form. I find this interesting because does this mean that United Healthcare and these entities have had negative experiences? If so, what has or is United Healthcare willing to do to make sure this health insurance transition is smooth, especially for the patient, those who rely on the doctors, clinics, and hospitals, places where relationships have been built over a number of years? If people use out-of-network doctors, clinics, and hospitals, and a lot of this happens in the more rural areas, especially out of state, how can we be assured that no one will have to make any of these payments up front? And I say that because, as you know, the state has been in arrears over claims. And while the state will be taken out of the mix because it's now being privatized, there still is some skeptics that the state of Illinois has their name attached to this. Maybe it's just no trust from the provider or no trust from those that are being insured. As we hear from our members, other concerns will be evident. As you hear from your constituents, other concerns will be evident. A serious burden of time pressure for anyone considering these changes or considering not enrolling in the new plan is compounded by the holidays approaching, people changing locations, and other things come into the mix. However, I know it becomes the responsibility of the retirees. Many of us are dedicated in a united effort to find family members, friends, caretakers, and others who can assist our most senior retirees in enrolling in one of the new Medicare Advantage plans. I hope all of you will be dedicated to this effort with us. It is unfortunate that a task such as this, completely changing the health insurance for our Medicare-eligible, age-eligible retirees, was not done over a longer period of time. Rushing makes people anxious, causes people to undue stress, and, of course, confusion that could have undeniably been avoided. Providing information to the Medicare population throughout the spring and the summer could have lessened the burden. It didn't have to be detailed, just letting people know that there were going to be changes would have been the right thing to do. But maybe the right thing to have done was align the Medicare Advantage plans with the 2014 Medicare enrollment. As we all know, transition and change do not always go smoothly. SUAA hopes that this transition works better than what is happening with the Affordable Care Act. And we do hope that everyone understands the necessity of enrolling in the new state-sponsored Medicare plans if one wants to be included. Education, education, education. We can only hope for the best in these next few weeks. Medicare retirees will be relying on all of us.
Thank you very much, Linda. And education is an important part of this, and I know my office will be working with CMS to bring them into the district and meet with a lot of my constituents. Are there questions of the commission for Linda? Okay. Seeing them. Beverly?
Right. Yes. Good morning. I'm Beverly Johns. Confusion, misinformation, and fear run rampant among my colleagues as a result of the proposed changes to the health insurance of those of us who chose to devote our careers to the education of children within this state. We worked many years for not the best wages and counted on our retirement plan and health insurance when we left the system. Some of us worked extra jobs in order to get enough Social Security to get Medicare. Because we paid into the teacher retirement system, we are only eligible for part of our Social Security, and now we learn that we are going to lose our Medicare because the state of Illinois used our retirement funds to pay for other priorities. Educators are being blamed for all the fiscal problems in Illinois. Now educators are facing a vastly reduced cost of living allowance, and their health insurance is becoming very complicated. Because I have my husband on my insurance, I received a letter that is a four-page legal-sized document from HMS Employer Solutions, a private company, as we've talked about, in Jeffersonville, Indiana. Even though I am originally from that area of Indiana, I didn't know whether it was legitimate. I contacted someone from the IRTA, and they didn't know anything about a letter from out of the state. This four-page document said that I was to send a tax transcript, not the front page of my federal tax return, which others thought was sufficient, and a required additional document, which could be a bank statement that must have my name and my husband's name, or a copy of my property tax bill that must have my name and my husband's name on it. What do people do if they don't have joint bank accounts or don't have a house in both of their names? I questioned under what authority an out-of-state firm had to such personal information. This four-page letter states, you are not to call CMS or the teacher retirement system, but you are only to contact HMS in Indiana. As a result, I contacted the Attorney General's office to see if this was a legitimate request or whether it was a scam. I finally learned that it was legitimate. I called another state agency who told me if I checked the CMS website, I would know this was okay. While I use the internet often, I don't typically cruise the CMS website, and I don't know too many retirees that do. Illinois had contracted with a private firm out of the state of Illinois to do an audit on those of us who have dependents on our insurance. When this state needs jobs and we are hurting for money, why are we sending money out of the state for a task that certainly should be able to be done within Illinois? A number of people I know simply sent the front page of their tax return only to find out that was insufficient. Accessibility for the elderly is a major concern of mine. What will an 85-year-old person do when they receive this kind of complicated letter? While I am fairly tech-savvy, what about elderly people who do not have a computer? Or if they have a computer, they would not understand what needed to be done. In order to get a transcript during the federal shutdown, it took me 2 days to complete the information correctly online. I was filling in our address the way it is on our tax statement, only to learn that the computer system would not take it that way. This scheme is ripe for identity fraud. Information can be faxed, but yet who knows who's on the other end of the fax to take the information? Why are people being put through this elaborate and complex process? I asked the question about whether it is to detect fraud or is it an attempt to cut off some senior citizens. If people got the information and thought it was a scam, they may not have completed it. Therefore, they lose their dependents' health insurance. If someone does not have access to all of the information and doesn't make the deadline, they lose their dependents' health insurance. If they complete it incorrectly, they lose their dependents' health insurance. We have now received notification online from organizations about the new health care that takes away our Medicare as we know it, and we now have a period of time to study and research different Medicare Advantage plans. Medicare Advantage is very different than the original Medicare. What about elderly individuals who, again, don't know what is happening because they don't have the internet? We are all awaiting the official letter we are supposed to get from CMS about our choices to replace our Medicare. All of these insurance plans are confusing to people who are older and don't have someone who is knowledgeable about the intricacies of health insurance. After all, they thought they would always have Medicare. If they don't make the choice within the short time frame, they again will lose their health insurance. I ask that you provide clear options, accurate information, and quit creating barriers for the elderly. Let senior citizens live our lives in peace. We didn't create these problems. Retired teachers never have free health insurance, and we pay over 75% of the cost of my husband's health insurance. We paid for our retirement with deductions from every paycheck, and now people blame us for the fiscal problems of the state.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions from the commission? Senator Stevenson.
It's always confusing when we're moving to new plans and giving people choices. But those who are not retired teachers, those who are retired out there, every October they have to go online and choose between 100 different drug companies and choose the new Medicare supplement companies. So every year there are individuals going through much more difficult than what this process is here. Every year they go through that in making those changes. So the goal is to give more choices and to help reduce the cost, which this is going to do. So while there's some confusion in how it was sent out, I hope today's hearing helped explain, which you can help get that message out to others, that the options are going to be there, that the benefits are going to be there, and while it may seem difficult, it's something that everyone else is going through themselves as they have to make those changes every year. Now, clearly, the income verification form, I think, was handled very poorly. I don't know why they didn't send out information ahead of time explaining what was going to happen. I think it's poorly handled, but it's necessary because if we're trying to save money, we don't want fraud to be occurring, and so that needs to be done. But clearly, the way it was handled is not done well. But I'm sure they'll follow up to make sure that people aren't removed that shouldn't be removed, and that's certainly I don't think was their intent in moving forward with it. So, but I appreciate you raising concerns. Those are things that over the next few weeks we'll be educating the public on.
Okay. We have crossed the 11 o'clock hour. We have an 11 o'clock committee meeting in this room. So I want to thank everyone for your patience today. I want to thank people for your time to take sessions. And this meeting of the Government Commission for Government Forecasting Accountability is adjourned.